Dr. Walter Russell was an American painter, sculptor, mystic, and author. Born in 1871 and passed away in 1963, his book, The Universal One, aimed to explain the universe through a mind-centered, electromagnetic perspective. Russell's work attempted to bridge science and spirituality, suggesting that the universe is fundamentally composed of light, and that all matter is an extension of this light, controlled by the mind or consciousness. His ideas challenged conventional scientific thought of his time, particularly in how he viewed energy, matter, and the nature of the universe. While Russell's ideas were met with skepticism by the scientific community due to their departure from the established physics, his work was also praised by Nikola Tesla, who once told him, quote, "Bury your findings until humanity is ready." In his book, Russell says, quote, "Sex is the apparent division of the father-mother substance of mind into apparent opposites. This division is due to the opposite desires of electricity and magnetism, expressed in the action and reaction of the thinking process. Sex is the active desire of mind for division into opposites, and its reactive desire for unity. Sex is that motive force which demands separability into two, and equally desires union of the apparent two into one. Sex force is the builder of the apparently many things out of the reality of the one thing. Man's concept of sex as beginning with organic life is a wrong concept. Sex is as absolute in the elements as in the complexities and compounds of the elements. Sex and life and light and intelligence are in and of all things from the beginning. The sex principle is as much part of the granite rock or bar of iron as it is of man. Sex is an electromagnetic equalizer of matter and motion. Sex is the apparent division of the one force into electricity and magnetism, two opposite forces, positive and negative, which are in reality but the two pulsations of the one force. Sex is as the apparent division of all things into their opposites, male and female. All things are both male and female. Apparent opposites of the indivisible substance of universal mind are not content to remain in the state of apparent opposition. All creating things are but the ideas of divine mind. All thinking is registered in light. All light is sex expression. Light is the language of all thinking. Light is the energy of all thinking. There is no other energy." Tesla was so awed by Russell's philosophy on cosmology and the nature of the universe that he told him to lock his findings in a time capsule for 1,000 years because, in his opinion, mankind was not prepared for it. While he never reached the scientific fame of Nikola Tesla or Thomas Edison, his work did find a niche following among those interested in alternative science, philosophy, and spiritualism, attempting to unify science with a spiritual understanding of the cosmos, though it remains outside of mainstream scientific acceptance. He was able to articulate a bridge between light, sound, color, form, and divine consciousness, which many suggest was a precursor or a parallel with modern quantum theories and the concept of consciousness affecting reality. The events that facilitated Walter Russell's insights into consciousness started when he was 7 years old, when he had his first out-of-body experience. At 14 years of age, he was reportedly pronounced dead after an attack of black diphtheria, but claimed he was asked to return during another out-of-body experience. He also claimed at some point to have been struck by lightning. Much later, in the 1920s, at the age of 50, and after meeting Nikola Tesla, Walter published and copyrighted his revolutionary spiral-shaped periodic chart of the elements. This dramatically different and artistic representation predicted new elements and shocked the scientific world by claiming there were in fact atomic conditions below hydrogen and additionally many more heavy radioactive elements to be discovered. Walter saw the spiral form, now so familiar to us, as the primary arrangement for the atomic and molecular assemblies of the universe. Walter's artistic ability let him illustrate his three-dimensional universe as a two-dimensional graphic, populated with cryptic notes. He would go on to produce dozens of these puzzling and artistic graphic representations of his theories of space, time, motion, and the cosmos, as well as over a dozen books explaining his theories, which seem to parallel little-known ancient wisdom passed down since antiquity regarding a universal life force energy, referred to as qi in Buddhist and Taoist philosophy, described as a vital energy that flows through the body and all things giving life. Prana in Vedic texts, known as the source of life that runs through the body's chakra or energy centers, and vril in European mystery schools, used to describe the bio-electromagnetic energy that can be harnessed to facilitate elevated states of consciousness, vitality, and spiritual awareness. These techniques became the guarded knowledge of occult secret societies, including an understanding of internal alchemy, or the esoteric transmutation of sex energy.
Hello. Can I have a selfie?
Yeah. Woo! Have a nice day.
You too.
At the age of 77, he left his wife of 50 years in 1946 after receiving a mysterious phone call from a Daisy Stebbing, a 44-year-old English model and businesswoman who Walter married and opened a foundation and museum for his work. She changed her name to Lao after Lao Tzu, the Chinese philosopher, and they continued to publish his theories until his death in 1963. At the heart of Walter Russell's philosophy lies the concept of light. Quote, God, the creator, divides his one light by extending its oneness into electrical tensions of vibrating red and blue pairs. The tensions of this electrical division are equaled by a desire for unity, which is attained at the point of white incandescence in matter. Unity thus attained is repeated forever by the same dividing, uniting process of electrical action-reaction pulsations. Reproduction cannot take place until the red and blue lights of sex-divided motion are voided in the still white light of the Creator. Man alone, of all creation, ever knows his omniscience. For him, light represented the animating principle of the universe, the source of all motion, rhythm, sound, color, texture, taste, smell, and feeling. It was the ultimate expression of divine intelligence and the key to unlocking human potential. Russell believed that we must learn to control and release light energy within ourselves if we hope to evolve as a species, honoring the sacred feminine aspect of creation and developing a deep reverence for nature as the mirror reflection of God. Some of his esoteric mysticism was mirrored in Germanic organizations, such as the Vril Society, which also researched occult topics ranging from metaphysics, higher potentials of human consciousness, and advanced anti-gravitic propulsion. These occult organizations were incorporated into the research department of the SS before and during World War II, which allegedly developed prototype anti-gravitic saucer technology, which was reported during the war as Foo Fighters, and ignited the modern UFO era with sightings such as the documented case as the Battle Over Los Angeles, and after the war, when a segment of nationalist Germany refused to surrender and allegedly retreated to a subterranean base in Antarctica and was victorious in a failed Allied attempt in 1946 to destroy it during Operation High Jump. And sets have been responsible for incidents such as the saucer crash in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947 and the UFO fly over the White House in 1952.
The crafts were named Brill, and Brill in Germanic language means the life force. Basically, craft utilizing the never exhaustible, always automatically replenishable life force. And then in a book on ancient occult, German occult traditions, they had a chart of the runic characters, and this is the runic character for the life force. So it all drives together. The name of the craft, Vril, the meaning of the word Vril, and the pictorial symbol on the bottom all mean the same thing, the life force. So we were able to decipher this little puzzle here. 17 of the Vrils were produced. Quite probably they were tested quietly, low-key testing, and then they were flown to the German South Polar colony. We will talk about it in detail pretty soon. And these are low-level photographs, the first real photographs of such craft in low-level flights over the testing grounds in Germany. It's probably the autumn of 1944. The leaves are gone from the trees. In this photograph, we can see the head of the pilot through the transparent perspex cupola of the craft. A very steep maneuver. Possibly the craft is moving in this direction upward because of all the edges, these and these edges are blurred. This happens usually with the edges with the attacking and the trailing edge of the craft.
What are those lines underneath?
Parts of the drive. In this enlarged photograph, we see an even better picture of the pilot inside. These two dark spots here could be the sunglasses that the pilot was wearing. The craft could go 2,900 kilometers in the atmosphere, almost two times the speed of sound. It definitely had the exoatmospheric and orbital capabilities. And I have a suspicion that these were free energy craft that did not need any fuel to fly. Once they were started and put in motion, I mean their gravity drives were activated, they did not need any more fuel to run. And we can see low-level flights, probably the autumn, early autumn of 44, the leaves are still on the trees. This visible asymmetricity here, if we divide a craft, it looks like the cabin has been blown backward by a strong wind, or it's kind of a cake melting in our refrigerator, just taken out of the fridge. Bigger craft, the Hollywood 2 type craft, which were 25 meter diameter, about 75 meter diameter tank killers, were also produced. They had one big drive, a ball in the middle, which was a tachyon drive, an electromagneto-gravitic drive, which they were calling the tachyon drives. The Thule tachyonators. The Thule tachyon drives were produced on assembly lines. They had an assembly line production of tachyon drives in their AEG and Siemens plants in 44 and 45. So in these underground caverns, they had more than enough space and fantasy and guts to build all these incredible flying machines. Armaments were added. These are machine guns in three turrets. On this photograph, we see some of the armaments here clearly visible. Something is sticking menacingly from the underside of the craft. A shot from the underside shows the Luftwaffe cross, either the four legs or four small machine gun turrets, and something that looks very suspicious, something here that we would see very soon resembles like a tank turret with a gun sticking out. These were really the tank killers of the Hollywood 2 type. They were designed to fight whole tank armies. The skeptics would say, well, it's impossible to do, what a stupid idea. It's impossible to put a tank turret on a saucer because it would never lift off. A tank turret is about 10, 15 tons. It's alone is two-thirds or maybe half the weight of the tank. However, the Germans claim that these craft were 100 tons in weight, armed with Brugge steel plates. They did not have developed at the time the force field shields around the craft that they developed later on. That's why they were relying on Brugge steel armor.
My chief, section chief, started through my background. And of course, it says all of this stuff that I had done in the Navy. So he puts me in this think tank inside of Douglas in a walled-off area. And there's 200 guys in it. And we investigate every aspect of extraterrestrial, military, commercial, whatever. So we had a young girl, Nordic, just outside of Germany. She had developed with I think she had 8 girls. They were continually talked to telepathically to go and design spaceships. The little blonde actually built them. Eventually, two of those got over here in Area 51. But Germany found out about the blonde, took her over, stopped everything, and then got to this point where there was some sort of pressurized program by the SS to control that original group. Now, several times they did work together, but Hitler allowed them to operate independently of the whole SS program, the whole development. So we had two developments going on in Germany. The girls didn't want their vehicles to be used for anything else but travel. They were afraid that somebody would get a hold of it and they use it for military, which is, of course, what they got. But the girls finally ended up in Antarctica. So there's cities manufacturing everything that you would need on a planet. 4 years before the war was over, it was decided that the war could possibly be lost, but if we win it, we still need to get out of the area because the Allies are going to bomb us off of the Earth and there won't be anything here left for us. So they decided to move to everything to Antarctica. Admiral Byrd, they're going to go down there and they were going to take out the whole thing in 1 week. The top people in every area of the Navy, best aircraft, best ships, best weapons, everything. And 5 weeks later, things didn't look very good. When we got down there, they had decided they were going to have one thrust from the west side of Antarctica and then the opposite side coming into both of them towards the center of the continent. And so before we even got all the guys around, and I'm talking about big four-engine flying boats, okay, and ships, battleships and destroyers and submarines and you name it. Before they got there, these fairly large, they were 100-foot diameter saucers, came up out of the ocean and took down everything. The pictures, that the photographs of some of the German UFOs. Many of the close-ups give you a little clear picture of the cross on them. But we lost that war.
For more on Antarctica, Operation High Jump, and what happened before, during, and after World War II, check out my video called Antarctica Disclosure. There should be a link to it in the description. This declassified CIA document from 1953 says, quote, "A German newspaper recently published an interview with George Klein, famous German engineer and aircraft expert, describing the experimental construction of flying saucers carried out by him from 1941 to 1945. Klein stated that he was present when, in 1945, the first piloted flying saucer took off and reached a speed of 1,300 miles per hour within 3 minutes. The experiments resulted in three designs. One designed by Meath was a disc-shaped aircraft, 135 feet in diameter, which did not rotate. Another designed by Habermal and Schriever consisted of a large rotating ring, in the center of which was a round, stationary cabin for the crew. When the Soviets occupied Prague, the Germans destroyed every trace of the flying saucer's project, and nothing more was heard of Habermal and his assistants. Schriever recently died in Bremen, where he had been living. In Breslau, the Soviets managed to capture one of the saucers built by Meath, who escaped to France. He is reportedly in the U.S. at present. This declassified CIA document from 1952 is titled Flying Saucers in East Germany and says, quote, "Furnished with the sworn testimony of an eyewitness, Oscar Link, a 45-year-old German and former mayor of Glimmershausen, West Berlin intelligence officers have begun investigating a most unusual flying saucer story. According to this story, an object resembling a huge flying pan and having a diameter of about 15 meters landed in a forest clearing in the Soviet zone of Germany. Link recently escaped from the Soviet zone along with his wife and six children. Link and his 11-year-old daughter, Gabriella, made the following sworn statement last week before a judge. Quote, "While I was returning to my home with Gabriella, a tire of my motorcycle blew out near the town of Hasenbach. While we were walking along towards Hasenbach, Gabriella pointed out something which lay at a distance about 140 meters away from us. Since it was twilight, I thought that she was pointing at a young deer. I left my motorcycle near a tree and walked towards the spot which Gabriella had pointed out. When, however, I reached the spot about 55 meters from the object, I realized that my first impression had been wrong. What I had seen were two men who are now about 40 meters away from me. They seemed to be dressed in some shiny metallic clothing. They were stooped over and were looking at something laying on the ground. I approached until I was only about 10 meters from them. I looked over a small fence and then I noticed a large object whose diameter I estimated to be between 13 and 15 meters. It looked like a huge frying pan. There were two rows of holes on its periphery, about 30 centimeters in circumference. The space between the two rows was about 0.45 meters. On the top of this metal object was a black conical tower about 3 meters high. At that moment, my daughter, who had remained a short distance behind me, called me. The two men must have heard my daughter's voice because they immediately jumped on the conical tower and disappeared inside. I had previously noted that one of the men had a lamp on the front part of his body, which lit up at regular intervals. Now the side of the object on which the holes had been opened began to glitter. Its color seemed green, but later turned to red. At the same time, I began to hear a slight hum. I then noted that the whole object had risen slowly from the ground. The cylinder on which it was supported had now disappeared within the center and had reappeared on the top of the object. The rate of climb had now become greater. At the same time, my daughter and I heard a whistling sound similar to that heard when a bomb falls. The object rose to a horizontal position, turned toward a neighboring town, and then, gaining altitude, it disappeared over the heights and forest in the direction of Stockheim. Many other persons who live in the same area as Link later related that they saw an object which they thought to be a comet. A shepherd stated that he thought that he was looking at a comet moving away at a low altitude from the height on which Link stood. After submitting his testimony to the judge, Link made the following statement. "I would have thought that both my daughter and I were dreaming if it were not for the following element involved. When the object had disappeared, I went to the place where I had been. I found a circular opening in the ground, and it was quite evident that it was freshly dug. It was exactly the same shape as the conical tower. I was then convinced that I was not dreaming." Link continued, I had never heard of the term flying saucer before I escaped from the Soviet zone into West Berlin. When I saw this object, I immediately thought that it was a new Soviet military machine. I confess that I was seized with fright because the Soviets do not want anyone to know about their work. Many persons have been restricted to their movements for many years in East Germany because they know too much. Regardless of whether the alleged saucer-shaped craft was Soviet or not, it was likely based on designs obtained from the nationalist Germans, if not belonging to the Nazis themselves. The story reminds me of the abduction case of Barney Hill, who along with his wife Betty had an encounter in 1961 with what they describe as a flying saucer whose occupants, according to the publicly available hypnosis session, described officers wearing SS uniforms. I couldn't help but think of the numerous similar UFO cases involving tall, blonde, blue-eyed, Nordic-looking passengers on disc-shaped craft as I headed off towards Palm Springs to attend a UFO conference called Contact in the Desert, where I was invited last minute by some friends, as one never knows who they might meet along the way. For those that are wondering, Contact in the Desert is a conference that's held once a year in Palm Desert, near Palm Springs, and usually runs for about 3 days. Although I did not attend as a speaker, I had a great time meeting many of the speakers who I'd only known through the internet. So it was great to meet in person and to get so much positive feedback from them and from other attendees. So I will try to make it back next year, possibly as a speaker next time. Of course, Palm Springs gets kinda hot, so I couldn't just leave without first taking a dip in the pool with some new friends to cool off. The philosopher Rumi said, quote, "The lamps are different, but the light is the same. One matter, one energy. One light mind, endlessly emanating all things." Of course, the light or life force energy is known by many names, like chi, prana, and vril. And while bioelectromagnetic energy can be harnessed and transmuted between people, the same can be said about anti-gravitic propulsion, which explains the obsession with secrecy, as the universal free energy that makes saucers fly is the same energy that will ultimately free mankind. That said, we've been waiting 80 years to be set free, and we have nothing to show for it but lies. So it's up to us to take disclosure into our own hands. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.